Lessons from Proudhon, our Pierre Joseph Proudhon readings. And he has been explaining why property is a shadow that has fallen across our hopes for humanity, a fog in our minds. It cannot be, he is saying, if society is to exist. And let's not forget that his definition of property, what he means by the word, is the sum of its abuses when it's used to destroy life, our humanity, to destroy our society, to destroy our individual self-sufficiency. He doesn't mean our building our own houses or our working and nurturing our land. He doesn't even see the need for dispossessing anybody as long as the human being is set free. We've been calling this decommissioning the class system. And one of the reasons we're reading Proudhon is to seek his help with this. And we're continuing with the very end of chapter 4, his proposition 9, and then chapter 5. 9, finally, property is not self-existent. An extraneous cause, either force or fraud, is necessary to its life and action. That is so key. And it's what Marxists tend to downplay or ignore in carrying power's water for it and pushing what has become a con, quote-unquote natural economic laws and theories of accumulation, continuing. In other words, property is not equal to property. It is a negation, a delusion, nothing. Turning now to chapter 5. Psychological exposition of the idea of justice and injustice and a determination of the principle of government and of right. Isn't that interesting that we have never had these discussions in our civics classes? Thank you, Pierre. Our education is sadly wanting. Property is impossible. Equality does not exist. We hate the former and yet wish to possess it. The latter rules all our thoughts, yet we know not how to reach it. Who will explain this profound antagonism between our conscience and our will? I am bold enough to undertake the task, and I hope to succeed. But before explaining why man has violated justice, it's necessary to determine what justice is. Part first of the moral sense in man and animals. The philosophers have endeavored often to locate the line which separates man's intelligence from that of the brutes. And according to their general custom, they give utterance to much foolishness before resolving upon the only course possible for them to take. Observation. It was reserved for an unpretending savant, who perhaps did not pride himself on his philosophy, to put an end to the interminable controversy by a simple distinction, but one of those luminous distinctions which are worth more than systems. Frederick Cuvier separated instinct from intelligence, but as yet, no one has proposed this question. Is the difference between man's moral sense and that of the brute a difference in kind or only in degree? If, hitherto, anyone had dared to maintain the latter alternative, his arguments would have seemed scandalous, blasphemous, and offensive to morality and religion. The ecclesiastical and secular tribunals would have condemned him with one voice. And mark the style in which they would have branded the immoral paradox. Conscience, they would have cried. Conscience, man's chief glory, was given to him exclusively. The notion of justice and injustice, of merit and demerit, is his noble privilege to man alone. The Lord of creation belongs the sublime power to resist his worldly propensities, to choose between good and evil, and to bring himself more and more into the resemblance of God through liberty and justice. No, the holy image of virtue was never graven save on the heart of man. Words full of feeling, but void of sense. Man is a rational and social animal, said Aristotle. This definition is worth more than all which have been given since. I do not accept even Monsieur de Bonald's celebrated definition, man is an intellect served by organs, a definition which has the double fault of explaining the known by the unknown, that is, the living being by the intellect, and of neglecting man's essential quality, animality. Man, then, is an animal living in society. Society means the sum total of relationships. In short, system. And I'm commenting here that I resist the word system with its mechanistic implications. That is, the definition says a set of things working together as parts of a mechanism or as an interconnecting network. I resist the idea that this word, so evocative of totalitarianism, has anything to do with human societies inherently, i.e. with our voluntary association, i.e. with our future. In our July 12, 2015 show, in which we discussed decentralization as an essential characteristic of our freedom, we quoted Paul Goodman's phrase, the organization is how we cooperate, which I really like. And it conveys a thing ever growing and changing as we learn ever more about our world and each other. I prefer this conveyance of the dynamic into our picture of freedom. For instance, Kropotkin's way of describing it, quote, and this is quoting Eric Fromm, Kropotkin summed up his idea of socialism in the statement that the fullest development of individuality will, quoting Kropotkin, combine with the highest development of voluntary association in all its aspects, in all possible degrees, and for all possible purposes. An association that is always changing, that bears in itself the elements of its own duration, that takes on the forms which best correspond at any given moment to the manifold strivings of all. Oh, that's just lovely. That's so alive and captures the ever-changingness of life itself, of what we deserve. We deserve to be able to live according to our inherent gifts. But he was standing, Kropotkin was, in a place decades on past this writing of Proudhon's, with the benefit of those decades of intense introduction to the ever-growing concentration of power in the centralized state of the advancing global totalitarian order. He had no choice but to come to grips with the full implications of it in his analysis, on which he based his strategic guidance.